H910 AM, W245 CT Hayward.
Always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. Neighbors in eastern Pennsylvania's Longwood Gardens getting a text about a reported sighting of escaped murderer Danilo Cavalcante, former FBI agent and ABC News contributor Brad Garrett.
I've done these type of ground searches, heavily forested with a lot of ground cover. So literally, unless you've got a dog with you that's sniffing him out, you could actually walk by him and you wouldn't know it.
Investigators still believe Cavalcante is still within the search perimeter. A jury finds former Trump advisor Peter Navarro guilty of contempt of Congress for refusing to comply with a subpoena from the House January 6th committee.
Sad day for America, not because they were guilty verdicts, because I can't come out and have an honest, decent conversation with the people of America.
Navarro's attorney says they will appeal. Play has now resumed at the U.S. Open semifinal. Climate activists had disrupted the match between Coco Gauff and Carolina Mukova. This is ABC News. Tourism to the Hawaiian island of Maui dropped so much since last month's wildfire, restaurants and tour companies are laying off workers. State officials now urging travelers to come back, but stay away from the burn zone. A generational divide overtaking the name of a spouse.
Signs the times are changing. A Pew Research survey released today finds some 40% of unmarried women say they will keep their last name or add a hyphen with their spouse's name when they marry. Compare that to the vast majority of women married to men, 79%, who say they wound up with their partner's last name. Just 19% surveyed say they chose to keep their birth name or hyphenate. The survey sampled 3,400 women and also found younger women are among those most likely of any age group to keep their names. Michelle Franzen, ABC News.
Snapchat rolling out a series of new features the company says will help better protect teens from toxic content online. Andy Field, ABC News.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. A few Wisconsin airports will be able to upgrade their infrastructure after receiving funding from the Federal Aviation Administration. The Dane County Regional Airport, Trove Field, Appleton International Airport, and Rhinelander-Oneida County Airport received a combined $23.5 million from the FAA's Airport Improvement Program to upgrade infrastructure like reconstructing a taxiway, improving lighting and safety, or expanding a terminal. Top officials from the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families testified at a public hearing this week, stating recent Republican proposed child care bills are not sufficient. Those officials argue that the bills don't address the biggest challenge, which is getting people to want to work in the child care industry. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers has stated that he would prefer taking $365 million in the state funds to extend the federally funded Child Care Counts program. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Wisconsin traditions have been built for years around the Badgers, game day, and the mascot. But lead miners are the original Badgers in the state, not the animal or the mascot. It was the 1820s, and the miners often didn't have shelter in the winters, so they lived like Badgers by digging tunnels into the hillsides to stay warm and sleep where they worked. It led to the reason why today you really can't think of Wisconsin without thinking Badgers. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons, like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person, That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Crute. Weekdays from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Low temperatures when shipped.
That is good news.
And finally, the Biden administration this week moved to impose a permanent ban on oil drilling across millions of acres of pristine Alaskan wilderness. The conservation action does not affect the controversial Willow Project due to a court judgment. In a separate announcement, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland moved to cancel all Trump-era drilling leases that had been permitted in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and restored the refuge's decades-long drilling ban.
Protections to be restored to Anwar.
Yep.
Excellent news. We'll take it. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.brandblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank-approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some interesting stories going on that make it kind of interesting. I mean, I look at there's a trial over at Google. You've got a judge vacating convictions in a bribery case over soccer broadcast deals. You've got a lot of this backroom stuff. That doesn't get a lot of attention, and I thought this would be a good time to maybe get into some of the weeds. That's why I've asked our good friend Morris Pearl to come talk with us. Morris is the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website. Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, it's great to be in your show, Rick. Thank you.
So walk me through. I see this story of, you know, this judge vacating these convictions of bribery over these soccer broadcasts. I don't watch soccer, so it was one of the things, you know, who knows? But this is an interesting argument with this Argentinian company. Walk me through some of this.
Well, basically, Fox Sports paid the head guy of the soccer league a big kickback in order to give them the rights to play like the World Cup on their network. And, you know, most people would call it kind of bribery. You know, they fired the guy. It's, you know, considered a bad thing if you give money not to the soccer league, but to the employee of the soccer league. But finally, the guys who were convicted 6 months ago in, you know, federal court here in the United States were let off now. And the basic claim is, well, the soccer rights weren't really an official act of the government of Argentina. So it's not really bribery because they're not really government officials. It came from a case, the new appeal came from a case where a associate of our former governor, Andrew Cuomo, was convicted of bribery and then let off by the Supreme Court on the basis that he wasn't actually a government official at the time. He was one of Cuomo's best buddies.
Sure.
And he had been a government official before, and he was a government official afterwards. But that particular day, he was a campaign volunteer.
Right.
And it's just like, I guess you're allowed to tell people, oh, I'm a friend of the governor, and if you pay me a lot of money, I'll lobby for you. That is what lobbyists do. But it just doesn't seem right.
Well, a lot of this stuff doesn't seem right, Morris.
It should be illegal.
It should be, but is it?
It, well, not according to the justices of the United States Supreme Court, it's not. You know?
See, now here's the thing. Got to wonder how much they got.
That's a really sad situation, too.
And the thing, here's the weird thing. Two years ago, I would have never said that. I would have said, look, you know, I think they're all, you know, they all wear those robes, make them NASCAR robes, yeah, all that stuff. I would have joked about it. But now we see all of this money that's flowing into these justices from friends. And, you know, how many friends do you got?
You can get a lot if you're a Supreme Court justice. I mean, I said in our book, Tax the Rich, where we were years ago, one of the things I found out in the 2004 campaign is that for a few tens of thousands of dollars, you can become anybody's best friend.
Yeah. Especially in the political world. And this is it was one of the more rude awakenings for me when I started doing this show 18 years ago. I had a friend who was a congressman from Illinois, and he said, look, you know, the reality is no one's ever bought my vote, but they get my ear 15 minutes at a time and for very little money. And it was amazing to me how little money it took to get their attention and to keep their attention. A couple thousand dollars here and there is what they were trying to raise. And that really stuck with me. I mean, the fact that he said, look, you know, they don't buy my vote, but if you hear it enough, if the difference between you and me, for instance, you make a couple of donations a year. I probably don't. The Congress people have got to take your call, and they will take your call because you got a checkbook. If they keep hearing from you over and over and over and over again, naturally, they're going to side with you.
It's sad, but true. I mean, I have cards say patriotic millionaires on them. Very few people turn down a meeting with the head of a group of millionaires, at least in our Congress. I had breakfast this morning with a Congress member who I don't remember ever meeting before, though maybe I did. You know, we spent an hour and a half talking about his concerns and my concerns and what we think should be done with the tax code and this and that. Never did we discuss, you know, anyone sending anybody money, but still, I don't, we were hundreds of miles from his district, if not thousands. And I doubt that he has time to spend an hour and a half with most of his constituents, much less some guy in New York who, you know, doesn't even know where his district is exactly. And it's just a sad state of affairs.
And this is why, again, you know, when you look at the things that actually get done, Wall Street beats Main Street every day.
Yeah. And we talked the other week about this Moore case about taxes that could save a lot of people a lot of money. We found out recently that the guys who were supporting, you know, who were suggesting Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court back when Trump was president, at the same exact time were recruiting the Moores to start that case. And it's just, I mean, the idea is that they were recruiting Kavanaugh specifically because he could rule that wealth tax is unconstitutional. And it's just a sad state of affairs. And I wish we had something to do about it. But, you know, I just think our country has just degraded so much over the past, well, particularly since 2016, that now, greed is good, and everybody's supposed to be greedy, and everyone's supposed to, you know, be corrupt. And
but wasn't that the 80s? I mean, wasn't that the heart of the go-go 80s? Greed is good. The one who dies with the most toys wins. This isn't new, is it?
Greed is good. Yes, Michael Douglas said that in the late 1970s, but he didn't say that corruption is good. That was not until the 2016 campaign that said, oh, you're supposed to be corrupt. People that play by the rules are stupid. People who pay their taxes correctly are stupid.
But what do you say to the person, Morris, who goes, Trump was just being honest and saying what everybody already knew?
No, there are dishonest people, but I think the vast majority of the people are honest. I think the vast majority of people play by the rules. Now, granted, a lot of them don't have opportunities to be dishonest and steal and cheat the way some people do, or they're not brave enough or whatever. But I honestly believe that most people are not corrupt. Most people do have a moral compass. Now, not the previous president. I mean, he honestly believes he's entitled to everything and, well, whatever's left over can go to whomever.
If there's anything left over.
But not everyone is like that. You know, I think that most Americans where you live and most Americans where I live don't steal things even if they think they have an opportunity. I really believe that.
Yeah, but here's the thing. You go back to this soccer case. The fact that, you know, Fox was able to beat out ESPN because of, you know, the palms they greased. You ask the average person and they believe that's how everything is accomplished. And Trump came onto the scene and said, yep, I bought one of the iconic moments of the debates. You know, I bought all these people. I've donated to all of them on both sides of the aisle because, you know what, I might need them one day.
That is just sickening. I mean, I donate a lot of money to a lot of politicians. I never say, oh, I might need them someday, because I donate to people who I think have good judgment, who I think are good people, who I think will do the right thing at the right time. I never donate to someone on the theory that they'll change their mind because I donated to them. I donate to people who are already doing what I think is the right thing in order to help them, you know, win their election.
No,
but fundamentally different.
Wouldn't somebody on the right say the exact same thing? I mean, one of the things that I have said about our Supreme Court is, you know, the reason that they're there is because they've been groomed from, you know, from basically day one of college, probably in high school, to sit in those places. They've been tested in every scenario. There's no guessing on how they're going to rule because they've been basically spoon-fed their entire career to be in this moment. So wouldn't the right say the exact same thing? You know, we're just supporting people who have our interests at heart, not the American people, not democracy, not society, but our individual interests.
Well, A, sometimes they do, and sometimes they're right. But, I mean, there are even some of our senators. Lindsey Graham said, oh, if we don't reduce taxes on rich people, they'll stop donating to us. And that implies that he believes there's a quid pro quo there.
No, that's an excellent point. But this is, again, another one of these moments where, you know, as a rich guy, don't you want to get money out of politics?
I do. I'd especially like to get my money out of politics. I mean, imagine how much I'd save if I didn't have to make political donations.
There you go. Well, and then think of all the things you could do.
But what I'm trying to do is use my money as best I can to make life better for my 4.5-year-old granddaughter. And right now, I believe that better than giving her a bunch of money is trying to change the rules so that we live in a country like when I grew up where people had opportunities.
Yeah.
And I think we'll all be better off that way, including my granddaughter.
Yeah. Before we went on air, you told me that you spent the day, you know, going to the park, playing in the fountain, doing all these great, you know, grandfather, granddaughter things. And, you know, as you were saying this, you know, what you had told me, you know, not too long ago about why you do this work is because you want to be able to do those things without fear of, you know, who knows what coming around the corner. That hit a chord with me.
Yeah, I mean, I live in the heart of New York City in a very safe place. And I live exactly where I want to live. I could live somewhere else if I didn't want to live here. And this is where both of my sons live, my granddaughter, my daughter-in-law, and we all want to live in New York City. And we all want to enjoy all the things, the universities, the hospitals, the fountains, the parks, the, you know, theaters, the concert halls, all the things that we have to offer because we are New York. And I hope my granddaughter grows up in the same kind of place that her father did.
But I keep hearing New York, like Chicago, like all major cities, especially Democratic cities, it's a burning hellscape of misery and crime and violence. And is that not so?
Not anywhere I've been able to see it. I mean, it's not so. You know, we don't have any more problems than we did 4 years ago or 8 years ago or 12 years ago. No, we don't. I mean, yes, there are people who steal stuff in stores. And there were 10 years ago, and there were 20 years ago, and there will be 10 years from now, too.
Yeah.
You know, there are some dishonest people. There are people who honestly don't have any other way to survive other than stealing, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I'd like to do something to help them, too. But no, it's certainly not gotten any worse over the last few years in any way that I have noticed.
Except the narrative that I keep hearing and that people keep emailing me. Those blue states are terrible. But before I let you go, I got to get your thoughts on the first Monopoly trial of the inner tubes as you know, Google's under microscope. Any thoughts?
What they're going to be debating is the criteria about whether it hurts consumers, you know, your regular typical people, or whether it hurts their actual customers, or the advertisers, or their competitors. You know, if you can't really argue they're hurting consumers too much because it's free. They don't charge anything to anybody. So it's hard to argue they're jacking up prices because there aren't any prices for consumers. You can argue they're hurting other companies who might want to be in, you know, business of supplying airline flight information or maps or anything else. You can argue that they're monopolizing the advertising business and advertising analytics. And I think that's what it's going to come down to. Are these laws that were written in the 1890s about sugar and railroads and steel, are they going to protect us from Google, which has over 90% market share in, you know, searching for things on the internet? And we're going to find out.
Yeah, maybe this is something that, you know, for years I've been saying needs legislation, needs regulation. We've allowed the Wild West of the internet to go unchecked. At least I think so, because it's gotten so pervasive in our lives, and there's so much information they have about us, and it's getting worse. I mean, you know, this is the weird thing. I was just my son and I are riding motorcycles. And, you know, he's learning and he's getting his license and all that. And I happened to be talking to him about something, a specific, you know, seat cover. And then all of a sudden Google says, hey, here's this wonderful seat cover that you were just talking about. I didn't look for it. I didn't Google it. I didn't search for it. I mentioned it. And somehow, miraculously, I'm not saying how, it knew and it was there for me. Now you could say, hey, that's great. You know, it's just getting the consumers what they need. It's helpful. Or you could say it's a major invasion of my privacy.
Well, it's a little creepy.
Not just a little.
I mean, I mean, a lot of people think that kind of stuff is creepy. I've had an instance like that too. And is it hurting me really? I guess not, but you know, it's certainly creepy. You know, and we're going to find out. And maybe this is the one thing that's sort of bringing all Americans together, is this fear of big tech taking over, you know, this fear of, you know, AI getting rid of everyone's jobs and big tech just sort of running the entire world. And I think that may be the one thing that's bringing people on both sides of the aisle together in supporting some additional regulation of technology.
Yeah, I'm leery of the future. I know the right has finally come around to the idea of a cashless society, something I talked about, I don't know, 8-9 years ago, as something I'm not in favor of. I'm a big fan of cash, but it seems like we're moving there. You can't go to a sporting event, a concert, or anything in that kind of a world and use cash anymore. It just doesn't happen.
I use very little cash now. And I like the idea that I can, but yeah, I know that, you know, you can look on some website, you can find out when I went through train stations today. You can pretty much find out where I was during different parts of the day.
Yep.
You can figure out, you know, where I got lunch and what subway line I took. And yeah, it's at best creepy. Yep. I kind of I've sort of decided I'm going to live with that. Now, and if somebody wants to know what train I took and where I had lunch, okay.
Yeah, I'm a little more leery than that. I hope you're right. I hope these are things that bring us together, that unite us, because I'm always looking for that thing. But as always, Morris, I appreciate you taking some time, sharing your insight. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Morris Pearl, chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website. Make sure you check out the work that they do there. Absolutely great stuff. Quick break. Back with your thoughts after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, I tell you, that's the idea of a cashless society. And you know, we had talked about this a long time ago. I use my credit card a lot. I do, because it is easy. But I've often said, you know, this is the more you use it, the more you get hooked on it, the more you move away from having a little coin in your pocket. And look, there used to be a $10 minimum that you, before you could use a credit card. You know, stores wouldn't allow you to, you know, buy a bag of Cheetos with a credit card. Now, thanks to the pandemic, that has accelerated in enormous ways. And I've said, look, you know, the thing that frightens me is the kind of insight into your life that one could get, you know, just from looking at your credit card receipts. Just looking at what you spend on, and you know, you can drill down. You know, we get these store cards. You know, every store has got a card now. Oh, you get a discount card. You go to the supermarket, it gives you a discount card. What does that do? It tracks everything you buy. Everything. Because you want the discounts, right? It's got to know it's there. And originally my mind went to this place because I think of, you know, insurance companies as evil. Necessary evil, but still evil. At some point they go, you know, yeah, you got cancer. Yeah, you got this disease. Yeah, this kind of... We went back into your records and, well, you know, you ate a little too much red meat. No, you know, you drank something. You did this. You ate this. We've got it all, you know, the last 25 years of your diet. And, well, you should have known better. So we're going to deny your claim. And I remember people say, no, you're just being paranoid. We find out that, you know, insurance companies were doing kind of something like that. They were going back into your life, you know, trying to find reasons to deny, you know, people's claims for, you know, well, you know, you didn't say that you took that acne drug back in the 80s. Of course, we now know that that causes cancer. You should have disclosed that. And there were teams of people who were digging through your past and getting bonuses when they could deny you care. Again, evil. Still necessary, but evil. So we'll be interesting to see how this Google thing plays out. I hope many view big tech with a suspicious eye. You know, I think, you know, the social media world that we now live in has been very destructive. I think, you know, and I've said before, the reality is social media allows many to be the worst version of themselves because they feel there's some anonymity there. They feel that, you know, well, you know, I can say or do whatever I want because there are no consequences. I'm concerned at where that takes us. And again, you know, the kind of craziness that gets thrown out there just to get attention. That's the weird part. And because I've always been the person who I don't want attention. I've never been the guy up on the end table with the lampshade on my head at the party. I'm not that guy. But it seems like we've become a society of people who want that. They want the spotlight. And usually for all the wrong, worst things. Or so it seems. Interesting times we live in. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast, wherever you get your favorite podcast. Make sure you get ours. They're all there, always available. Also, remember the Michael Harrison podcast episode I talked about at the beginning. That's a must listen. Obviously, Michael, the head of Talkers Magazine, which we are part of the Heavy 100. Thanks to the good folks over there for including us in their list. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1916. That was the day that the Federal Employees Compensation Act was signed into law by President Woodrow Wilson. The act was sponsored by Senator John Kern, a Democrat from Indiana, and Daniel McGillicuddy, a Democratic congressman from Maine. The act provided compensation for federal civil service employees that lost wages because they were hurt or killed on the job. There was great debate at the time over whether employees injured at work deserved to be compensated. Before the turn of the 20th century, those who sustained workplace injuries had little recourse. Employers blamed workers for accidents and typically refused compensation, leaving families destitute. Edward Gaynor, the president of the National Association of Letter Carriers, explained the debate around the 1916 proposal, saying, quote, "The only question, the fundamental question involved in this discussion is whether or not society should bear the burden of the injured worker in any industry." Increasingly, some lawmakers were beginning to make the case that society should indeed bear that burden. Workers and labor leaders organized around issues of workplace safety and demanded a compensation if they were injured on the job. The law providing such a safety net for federal employees was passed through the House of Representatives by an overwhelming margin of 288-6. Although the act only applied to federal employees, it was an important step forward in recognizing that all workers deserve to be compensated for workplace injuries. The Federal Office of Workers' Compensation Programs that operates today traces its history directly back to the 1916 Act. And because of this 1916 Act, 3 million federal employees and their families are covered under the Act's protection.
A few days ago, the city of Savannah, Georgia, took an important symbolic step toward racial inclusiveness, naming one of Savannah's 23 historic public squares for a black woman. Susie King Taylor, born in 1848 to enslaved parents, became a renowned educator, setting up schools for emancipated children and adults, a laudable role model in America's ongoing struggle to extend equal opportunity to all. Before adding Taylor's name, though, the name that had been plastered on that square 170 years ago, John C. Calhoun, had to be subtracted. Council members did that last year, finding the South Carolina senator and two-time vice president unworthy of any public honor. Why? Well, why would Georgians of 1853 create a monument to a lawmaker from another state? Answer, slavery. No politician in our history has been a more vehement apologist and promoter of human enslavement than Calhoun. Thus, racist Southern leaders revered him. A rich son of plantation privilege,
welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Kamala Harris is launching a college tour. Going to get out there and mobilize young voters in battleground states. under the heading of Fight for Our Freedom College Tour. It's going to kick off on September 14th at Hampton University in Virginia. And look, at the end of this coming election, look, we're told this every election. It's going to be the young people coming out and voting, and the young people are going to have to save us. I kind of think that this is going to be one of those times. We need college students. We need young people to come out and vote like never, kind of like their lives depend on it. Because, I don't know, might. But here to share some thoughts on, the big tour and also, you know, what the younger generation should be doing, what they are doing, and maybe how they save the planet. I've asked Lauren Baer to come talk with us. Lauren's the managing partner over at Arena. Arena.run is their website. Lauren, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me. I'd love to end my evening on Progressive Radio.
So what do you think of the big college tour that Kamala is going to kick off, getting out there and talking to college students, motivating people to, get active, get engaged, maybe voting?
I think this is incredibly important. And I think it's a recognition not only of the important role that young people will play in the 2024 elections, but the critical role they've actually played in several elections over the last recent years. You know, interestingly, when you look at 19 to 25 year old voters, for the first time ever in the last two midterm elections, more than 60% of them went for the Democratic Party. And what we've seen is a trend that was unleashed by Trump and has only been exacerbated by the authoritarian and rightward trend in Republican politics of really aligning young folks with the Democratic Party because they know that their lives and livelihoods depend on it. So the administration is absolutely right to be going to campuses, to encouraging people to vote. But more than that, we need to be inviting young people to have a more permanent, more enduring place in our politics. And that's really what we at Arena do. We try to harness that energy, that enthusiasm, sometimes that anger that people have towards what's going on in the country, and tell them that they too can get trained, get a role in our civic and political ecosystem, and really make a difference, not just on election day, but year round.
Yeah, but you hit a number there. 60% of young people broke for the Democrats and Biden, which is why you look at someone like Vivek Ramaswamy, who's saying, you know what, we need to raise that voting age to 25, and we need a literacy test. You know, not a literacy test for those people over 50 who say some really crazy things at Trump rallies, but for those young people who are breaking the way you described.
What he's proposing on the campaign trail is entirely consistent with what Republicans in the Republican field more broadly have been doing, which is taking a tack that advances voter suppression because they know that that's really their only path to victory. National popular vote has broken for Democrats in recent years. To the extent that there are Republican majorities, it's because of voter suppression and gerrymandering. And so, it's not a surprise that's what they favor. It is somewhat surprising that they say the quiet part out loud now when they didn't used to do that until the recent past. But what I think it means more than anything is that we know what we're up against, and we have to ensure that that is not who holds office in 2024 and beyond.
You know, earlier I talked about an interview I had done with Michael Harrison, the guy who's the head of Talkers Magazine, last week. And he told me, he goes, you don't sound like a left, like someone on the left. You don't sound like a liberal. You don't sound like that. And the reality is, it's probably true, because what's happened over the years is anytime you hear about who someone on the left is, who someone who is liberal is, it's coming from someone who's on the right, trying to explain who and trying to pigeonhole people on the left. So do you see that kind of happening with young people as well? That that they're being pigeonholed into some of these more extreme positions that keep getting thrown out there to make them look either stupid or incapable of leading. Any thoughts?
Well, what I would say is that Democrats as a whole, and this extends to young people as well, we're a heterogeneous coalition. We don't all look the same. We don't all think the same. I think that's the beauty of the party, is that we have always found strength in our diversity. And I think the path to winning is recognizing that we may come from different places. We may be of different races, religions, creeds, sexuality. But overwhelmingly, what is motivating people to vote Democratic is one, an understanding that our democracy depends on it, but two, a real understanding that our lives and livelihoods depend on it. You know, whether it comes to taking any kind of meaningful action on gun control or reproductive freedom or LGBTQ rights, there's only one party that is truly advancing a position that recognizes the inherent dignity and value of all Americans. And so, you know, I really think that our electoral strength is greatest when we lean into that diversity as a party. And we at ARENA, certainly as an organization, have been a big tent organization. We see folks of all different stripes come to us for our training, seeking to be, to find a bigger place in politics. And we think that that's a good thing because, you know, we're going to need all comers in order to win.
Yeah, it's an all hands on deck situation. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Lauren Bear. She's managing partner over at ARENA. ARENA.run, the website, if you want to take a look at the web, at the work that they do. Now, you guys run this ARENA Academy to do the kind of training that you're talking about. You know, walk me through, you know, what it is, what people can expect, and is there like an age range? Is there you know, a maximum, minimum? What is it?
Sure. So first of all, the premise behind ARENA Academy is that we understand that it takes great candidates to win election, but candidates can't win elections on their own. They need really strong, well-trained teams behind them. And so what we do at an ARENA Academy is we take folks who might not know anything about politics, might not have been involved before, but have that energy, that enthusiasm and drive, and we train them to be campaign managers, we train them to be organizers, we train them to be digital and data directors. And then after that, we go and we help them find jobs around the country and up and down the ballot. And, you know, we do see quite a few young people, but it's not just young people. We trained someone in Texas last year who was a 30-year veteran firefighter, and in his retirement, didn't want to just sit back and watch our democracy get taken away from him. We trained him. He went to Georgia and worked as an organizer for the Reverend Warnock. We get people all of the time who are career changers, who want to take their skills and experiences and apply them to the civic and political realm. So yeah, there are a lot of young folk, but we, again, are a big tent. And I would encourage anyone who is interested in getting involved and personally making a difference to check out our trainings.
So it's not just Gen Z you're focusing on. It's everyone. But I think you would like to grab a bunch of Gen Z to get them out there.
Of course. And of course. And they are the biggest cohort.
No, because look, I have some hope for the future. If it weren't for the number of kids that I've met, and I probably shouldn't call them kids, but if it weren't for the number of people that I've met in that generation who are, you know, almost as pro-labor as I am, who have a vision for the future that they want to live in and that they want to create, I would be I'd be in a fairly dark place right now, given what I see coming down the road. But the fact that there are people out there who are fighting the good fight gives me hope for a future.
It certainly keeps me hopeful as well. You know, I get the question quite a bit, how do you do this work day after day and in an environment where it seems like Republicans just keeping coming up with sort of one, you know, an even more diabolical plan day after day to really try to diminish the least fortunate among us. And what keeps me going is the folks who are coming to our training, individuals who are survivors of gun violence and who want to take that pain and trauma and channel it into action. Individuals who are trans and are seeing, you know, their very existence threatened in so many places around the country and want to build political power, not just for the trans community, but for all Americans, you know, women who are concerned not just for themselves, but for their children and future children, about whether they're going to have control over their own bodies and reproductive freedoms. You know, these people are taking everything that is being thrown about that at them that is meant to discourage them and dissuade them from getting involved and is intended to make them feel hopeless. And they're saying we won't. They're taking the opposite approach, which is to raise their hand and jump in the arena. And it, you're right, it's a very hopeful and inspiring thing to watch.
No, I mean, this campaign season is going to be very interesting on a number of levels. The presidential, obviously, but it's all those local races. And, you know, I cut my teeth, you know, working, you know, stuffing envelopes on campaigns. I'm hoping we still do all of that. But, you know, we've gotten a little bit more training focused because you've had to. I mean, the right has built an incredible machine. I mean, you look at, you know, from their state policy networks to their dominance on cable news and talk radio, they have built institutional power that the left and Democrats never did, because we always relied on people power and you know, the power of us, you know, getting out in the streets, because ultimately, while they have all the money, we've out-procreated them. It's good to see us finally maybe doing some of that organizing.
You know, I think you're exactly right on this. I mean, what the right has done over the last 40 years is two things, which have been smart. One is recognize the importance not only of winning at the top of the ticket, but down ballot and dominating in state legislatures and local races and school boards and the like. But two is playing the long game, which is recognizing that you don't win anything or everything in a single election cycle. Some victories require a 10, 20, 30 year time horizon. And on the left, I think we're starting to catch up with those truths. We need to be competing everywhere, from the smallest local race for city council or mayor of a small town, all the way up to the presidency. And we can't think about this as on years and off years. It is 365 days of the year, every single year, to build the kind of power we need to sustain victories over the long run.
Well, like they say, democracy is participatory. I hope people join in. I hope people check out the website arena.run. You can go there to get more information and sign up to be part of the academy, get some training, get involved, get active, get engaged. I have some great hopes. Final thought?
Rick, I just want to thank you for having me here and echo what you said. Our democracy depends on each and every one of us to be a full and active participant. And we at Arena want to help you find your place in politics. So come join us.
There you go. Good stuff. I appreciate the time, Lauren. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Lauren Bear, managing partner there at Arena, arena.run. If you're interested, if you want to join up, work on campaigns, help out, learn more, that's where you go. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break, right back with your thoughts. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1980. The 32nd Annual Emmy Awards show took place despite 51 of the 52 nominated performers boycotting the event. At issue was a strike by the members of the Screen Actors Guild. Powers Booth was the only nominated actor to attend. He won the Emmy that year for portraying the cult leader Jim Jones in a made-for-TV movie. In his acceptance speech, he acknowledged his lonely presence at the Emmys. He said, "This is either the most courageous moment of my career or the stupidest." SAG members, along with the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists and the American Federation of Musicians, all went on strike that summer. Members of the Screen Actors Guild were displeased with their salaries. They wanted a 32% increase. They were
were also concerned about changes in the industry. They did not feel they were being compensated for the revenue they helped generate through paid cable and video cassettes. The Screen Actors Guild had its origins in the Maskers Club. Actors formed that club because they were upset with the grueling hours expected of them by Hollywood studios. Eventually, in 1933, the Screen Actors Guild was started. After initial hesitation by some big-name actors to join the union, SAG membership grew from 80 to more than 4,000 members. Many famous actors supported the union, including Humphrey Bogart and James Cagney. In the late 1940s, future President Ronald Reagan was elected president and served as president of SAG for 7 terms. The 1980 strike was one of the longer strikes in the union's history, lasting 94 days. And settling at the end of October.
Hooray for Hollywood, that phony super coney Hollywood.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So Vivek Ramaswamy, I mean, I think this guy's just throwing things out there to get attention. I honestly, you know, the idea, you know what, we should raise the voting age to 25. He knows he can't do that. You know, that's never going to happen, but throws it out there anyway. Why? Because he wants to continue that age divide. Now he's going, you know what, felons should have, ex-felons, you know, they should have guns. This is a guy from the same party who doesn't think that former felons should be allowed to vote, but we're going to give them concealed weapons. Again, playing to that gun fetish. And now here's the weird thing. This is one of those weird things. By saying this, I gotta wonder, you know, all of my gun nut friends who, you know, a lot of them believe that we should have stronger background checks. A lot of them believe that we should have some baseline sanity. I don't know that they're going for this. I know this was to get attention. I get that, because you know he needs that. But I don't know that it's gonna. I don't know it's gonna help. And look, this idea that we're gonna raise the voting age to 25, and it's not gonna happen. You would need a constitutional amendment, and it would not pass. The weird thing is that this I believe would make that number that 60% of young people breaking for Democrats probably even worse. Because how many people under 25 are going to go, you know what? Yeah, I should have to take a literacy test. I shouldn't be allowed to vote. I spend a little time, you know, when I have a couple of down minutes scrolling through some of the, you know, the videos, the reels, the Instagram stuff. And it's amazing how many young people have gone, so let me get this straight. 18, I can go to war, but I can't vote? Is that what you're telling me? Because I can't already drink. You've already taken that from me. I can go die in war, but I can't have a beer. And now you want to take my right to vote? Which brings me back to, you know, why are 40% of young people voting for Republicans? How is that possible? And then the literacy testing, you know, I got into this back and forth with my producer of going, well, you know, maybe we should have a literacy test. Maybe you should know some basic tenets of how our government works. And he was dead set against it. No, absolutely not. Because, you know, jelly beans. For those who don't know, you know, in Alabama, one of the tests was guessing how many jelly beans were in the jar, and you were never going to guess. Meaning, you know, black folks were never going to vote. And if you look at the literacy test that they had back in Alabama in the 60s, virtually no one would pass it. And that was the point. So, you know, as a mental exercise, I'm going, well, you know, I got to be honest with you. There are a lot of people I know who vote for Republicans who don't know anything. You know, maybe it's enticing until you realize, you know, I guess it comes down to, you know, who's given the test. That's a scary thought. I mean, think
you know, the image of my high school civics teacher just popped into my head. And to be honest, he was the person who really turned me on to politics. Really turned me on to the idea that government is important, that political activity is important. And it was very simple. You know, it was, you know, he said, look, at the end of the day, politics is, you know, is how things get done. Government decides who gets what. And I'll never forget, you know, it was 1984. And he was, he said, you know, none of you 18-year-olds, none of you vote. Don't vote. I don't want any of, don't bother. He said, this way it makes my vote stronger. The more of you who don't participate, the more of you who stay home, the better it's going to be for me, because I'm going to be able to have, my vote's going to matter more. And I'm pretty sure that's the reason he said that, was to motivate people to go, well, why should you have more of a voice than I have? I'm going to go out there. I'm pretty sure that's the reason. But I just thought of him. Now, as I found out years after, he actually did vote for Reagan. He was a dyed-in-the-wool conservative, and you know, for the time, fairly radical conservative. I never knew that from his teachings. He was very straight down the middle of the road, very, you know, figure it out for yourself. But he was the one thing that I do remember more than anything as it's, well, how do you know which party you belong to? How do you decide? Do you flip a coin? Do you get assigned that? Because my grandparents were not politically active. They were not, I don't think they ever voted that I can remember. And his response was very simple. He said, well, you have to decide. Are you going to be rich or poor? And if you're rich, clearly you're going to want to be with the Republicans, because they're going to call for tax cuts, because that was the big thing then, deregulation, all the things that Reagan was pushing for. And if you're poor, as I was, you're going to probably be a Democrat, because you're going to want, you know, more social programs to help the poor. You're going to want better access to health care and education for poor people that I remember using, and I remember being bad as a kid. He said, but if you're in the middle, you then have to decide which one you're closer to. Are you closer to being rich or closer to being poor? Is your future prospect going to be you're going to be one of the very well-to-do? Or is it possible you miss a couple of paychecks and you're back to being poor? And to be honest, in the classroom that I was in, most of the people at that time were going, well, we're going towards being Democrats. Because of that safety net, because of that idea of community that he talked about, he did a really good sell for being, you know, being a Democrat and pushing for more social programs and more help for working people. Only to find out later he was a big Reagan guy, which is quite remarkable to me. But I look at, we're in this situation right now where I don't know that there are policies that the Republicans are pushing that would grab working people. I don't get the draw at this moment. We're in a weird situation. But I'll tell you one thing. If young people don't come out to vote this election cycle, because I'm already hearing the media frame, well, you know, people are walking away from Joe Biden. The polling, you know, it's neck and neck. I don't put any credence in any of the polls. I'll bring them up. I'll say, here's what this poll says, and try and talk about it that way. But I don't put any real faith in them anymore. When you find out that you know, Trump spent what was $700,000 on that poll that the Wall Street Journal talked about. When you realize the person who writes the question and who you ask the question to matter more than the actual questions, it kind of taints the kind of taints the polls. And that's, I think, why they do it, to create that idea of a horse race, to create that idea that there's something out there that, you know.
You're listening to WLAK 1260 AM Amory and WBZH 910 AM W245 CT Hayward. Always streaming on the ABC Civic Media News app.